Payne versus Pauley, Mr. Flaxman.
May it please the court. The plaintiff in this civil rights action asserted two claims. The first is that she had been arrested without probable cause. The second is that excessive force had been used in arresting her. Both of those issues are judged by a Fourth Amendment standard, even though one of the cases on which the defendant relies in this court applied the 14th Amendment standard to find there was no excessive force used. The district judge granted summary judgment in favor of the defendant. The starting point, and I believe the ending point for the summary judgment analysis, is the first sentence of the defendant's statement of facts, which begins, there are clearly two stories in the present case. It seems to me that if there are two stories and the plaintiff wins under one, there has to be a trial and summary judgment can't be granted. In addition to the question of whether there were disputed questions of fact or whether or not there were two stories in the case, there are two other issues that are presented in this appeal. The first involves unpublished district court orders. Back in 1989, this court said our rule prohibiting the citation of our unpublished orders does not apply to unpublished district court orders. More recently, in I think two or three years ago, a case called Wyatt versus UNUM, the court said our rule does apply to unpublished district court orders. There should be one rule so that persons who practice before this court can know whether or not they can cite unpublished district court orders. The second issue that's presented in this appeal involves the closely related offense doctrine. When that doctrine was originally applied to civil rights cases, there was this safety gap that the court said, well, we're not going to allow a retroactive making up of facts if no reasonable police officer could have believed that this related offense had been violated. The court's reliance on the safety valve of subjective intent seems no longer to be permissible. And what the district judge in this case did was to say it's not closely related, it's loosely related. It makes sense that there should be a two-pronged standard as the First Circuit adopted in Shealy versus Town of Plymouth.
Yeah.
What I think is somewhat dubious in your case, she does have her version of what happened, but nobody supports her version, right? There are a lot of other people there.
There's the witness who was deposed who says that it was the cop who was yelling at her, the cop who started it, the cop who was cursing at her. We have 45 minutes at the scene where the cop is creating a disturbance.
Why does any of that matter? Even if we view the facts as most favorable to your client, would an officer's rude and boorish behavior entitle a citizen to engage in disorderly conduct?
If the creating a disorder is what the officer did, if the officer is encouraging the bystanders to yell at him saying, don't hit that woman, don't do that, don't hit her, and that's creating disorder, but it's the officer who's creating the disorder. It's not the woman, it's not the citizen, which is what the facts are viewed in the light.
Did anybody testify that he was hitting her?
I think the evidence was that he butted her and
But now that's her evidence. Did anybody corroborate that?
I believe that the independent witness said that he raised his hands towards her.
No, I understand that, but the butting.
That's her testimony. She said he came at me and he pushed me.
But nobody supported that. Even though there were loads of people around.
Well, only one of them was deposed. And if it wasn't a trial, this is summary judgment. Everybody wasn't deposed, and that's the one witness who was deposed by the defendant. It might be that a jury would find in favor of the defendant in this case. A jury, there's also enough evidence for the jury to find in favor of the plaintiff, and it should have been the jury rather than the judge.
Mr. Flexman, even if we were to accept the First Circuit's two-prong test for deciding whether something's a related offense, aren't the two offenses here directed generally at prohibiting the same type of conduct? In other words, in this case, the disorderly conduct or the disturb and threaten the public order by obstructing the work of a police officer. No?
No. I think Your Honor's taking the defense-warped view, if I may, of disorderly conduct and obstructing. The obstructing charge, the sworn complaint that Officer Pauly filed, said that the plaintiff, Ms. Payne, obstructed my arrest of her son. And at the time she obstructed the arrest of her son was in handcuffs in the officer's car. That doesn't make any sense at all, that she obstructed the arrest of the car. When this came to court, the officer's theory was that, well, she was creating a disturbance by letting me yell at her. That seems to be a different offense of physically obstructing a police officer is the obstruction charge, and letting an officer yell at you and outraging the citizenry who are watching seems to be a totally different offense.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Selpka?
Good morning, Your Honors. If it may please the court. Your Honor, I think the facts of this case clearly demonstrate that Judge Norgel was correct in granting summary judgment on both counts in this matter. When it comes down to it, there was a large crowd. Officer Pauly had to maintain public order. Clearly, there was an argument between Ms. Payne and Officer Pauly. Whoever started the argument, clearly the argument did occur, and the crowd grew hostile as the argument progressed. And arguing with a police officer in front of a hostile crowd is clearly probable cause for disorderly conduct. Pardon, Your Honor?
Why? If the police officer is behaving in an untoward way, and there's a crowd hostile because the police officer is misbehaving, that gives the police officer probable cause to arrest you? Sounds like it would give the police officer probable cause to arrest himself.
Your Honor, if you respond to a rude police officer and start engaging a police officer, and this continues to create a hostile situation.
If the police officer is rude toward you, and you're rude toward the police officer, how is that probable cause to arrest you? And the Supreme Court has, in fact, said that using cuss words at a police officer, even a police officer who is polite, is protected by the First Amendment. How can it also be probable cause to arrest?
It is probable cause to arrest when there is a threat to public disorder. As this court has noted in Humphrey v.
Yes, but as the plaintiff's affidavit describes it, the threat to public order came from the police.
There was no plaintiff's affidavit, Your Honor. There are inferences from the deposition that the plaintiff would like you to draw. The police officers have to be occasionally, they have to act in an intimidating manner, they have to give orders, and Officer Pauly has to be there, had to be at the accident scene, whereas Mrs. Payne did not.
Why do you assert that the plaintiff used only uncorroborated assertions to contest summary judgment? She corroborated her testimony, at least some of her testimony, with testimony from her witness, Rashida Gray.
Your Honor, all the material facts which would lead to a finding of probable cause were uncorroborated as to Mrs. Payne's story and corroborated as to by the testimony of Officer Pauly, Officer Masciarello, and Ms. Gray.
So what? I mean, I thought it was an old saw that everybody learned in first year law school, that if you had on the one side the testimony of a convicted perjurer and you had on the other side the testimony of 20 bishops, presumably being allowed to wear their mitres in the courtroom, the jury could believe the convicted perjurer.
Well, Your Honor, the precedents of the Seventh Circuit don't suggest that. There are, I cite four cases in my brief, Weeks versus Samsung Hemi Industries, Cowan versus Glenbrook.
This is a little difficult because many of our criminal prosecutions depend on the testimony of convicted perjurers.
Well, Your Honor, this is a civil
case.
We'll
put to one side the criminal prosecutions of Catholic bishops. Perhaps are going on in Boston.
Your Honor, at least in the civil context, when it comes to a motion for summary judgment, the self-serving, uncorroborated testimony of a plaintiff is not enough to...
I just don't understand why. The Supreme Court says that the standard for summary judgment is whether a reasonable jury could believe the party opposing the motion, where there's enough evidence, right? So we have to ask the question whether, if there was a trial, and the plaintiff testified as she did in her deposition, and the jury believed it, we would be required to reverse.
Your Honor, I don't believe a reasonable jury could believe the plaintiff's testimony.
Why not? You have one, I mean, her testimony is true. It's contradicted by everybody else in the world. But that's just the 20-bishop rule, one would think.
But, Your Honor, the Seventh Circuit hasn't adopted the 20-bishop rule. The Seventh Circuit has adopted the rule set forth in Weeks versus Samsung Heavy Industry, and Cowan versus Glenbrook, and Filippo versus Northern Indiana Public Service.
Is any of her testimony physically impossible, inconsistent with the kind of evidence that you can't overcome? That is, was there a videotape of anything that happened here? Photographs, recordings?
Her testimony as to her damages, I think, is physically impossible. Her testimony as to the argument, I suppose it's theoretically possible, yes. But
what's your best case for your approach to summary judgment?
Your Honor, my best case approach is that even if you take only the facts that...
No. You reeled off several cases.
Right.
Now, which you claim... reject the 20-bishop rule. So what's your best case, and what is the standard that you extract from it?
My best case is that a question of material fact demands that a reasonable jury...
Best case is a case, you know, with a name.
Oh, my best case? Weeks versus Samsung Heavy Industries.
Pardon?
Weeks versus Samsung...
Okay, now what is the standard that it sets forth?
The standard that it sets forth is that in order to overcome summary judgment, a plaintiff must show a question of material fact, but that the self-serving, uncorroborated testimony of a plaintiff is not enough to create a question of material fact.
Well, I don't think that can be right.
Can't possibly.
Can't be right.
First of all testimony by the plaintiff in a case is self-serving.
Yes, Your Honor.
So now what you're saying is that a plaintiff's testimony has to be corroborated in order to create a jury issue. I don't think that's the law.
Perfectly common in tort cases or even in contract cases where extrinsic evidence is used for it to be a he said, she said situation, right? Plaintiff testifies to one thing, the defendant testifies to the other, and the jury's entitled to believe it. And in your view, if the plaintiff doesn't have a second witness, the plaintiff loses at the summary judgment stage.
When there are other witnesses on the side of the defendant, yeah, I think, I believe...
We've never followed the rule that whichever side has more witnesses wins.
No, Your Honor, but there should be some corroboration.
Well, there was. There's Rashida Gray.
That for treason. But this isn't a treason prosecution.
No, it's not, Your Honor.
You know, according to Officer Pauly's brief, according to your brief, Ms. Payne resisted being handcuffed, and... I'm going to quote, this fact alone gave Officer Pauly cause to arrest her for obstructing a police officer. But under this theory, Officer Pauly would have been arresting and handcuffing her prior to having probable cause to arrest her. Isn't that right?
Yes, Your Honor, the probable cause was created during the transaction, during the arrest, yes. However, you're right. He would have decided to arrest her prior to actually having probable cause.
Well, that can't be, can it?
Well, Your Honor, the officer's subjective legal belief as to the legality of the arrest is irrelevant as long as there are facts which justify the arrest.
Well, but doesn't the officer have to have probable cause? Or
after viewing it post hoc, if the judge who views it sees that there are facts which justify probable cause, then probable cause for the arrest would exist. And Judge Leinenweber makes this point in Penn versus Chicago State, where he says that the officer's subjective belief of the legality of arrest is irrelevant. It's the facts which are on the ground, which are undisputed, that the court has to determine to see whether the Fourth Amendment has been satisfied. Now, the fact that he may not have had a legal basis for the arrest when he decided to do so really doesn't seem to me to be relevant when Ms. Payne clearly violated the law by resisting his attempt to secure her for arrest.
So he can have no probable cause and start handcuffing?
Yes.
Okay, what's the town again?
Chicago Heights, Your Honor.
Okay, because I want to stay away.
If you resist the handcuffing, then his arrest would be justified.
No, he'd be handcuffing me before I resisted.
Yes.
To your theory.
And you would have a Fourth Amendment claim as long as you did not resist. However, if you resist the arrest, you're committing the crime of obstructing a police officer, regardless of whether that offense is proper.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Stoutzel. Mr. Flaxman, how much time does he have?
Just one very, very brief point, which is back to my thing about unpublished district court orders. If the court adopts the rule saying you can't cite unpublished district court orders, the court should also address the question of what happens when that unpublished district court order was affirmed by this court on different grounds than the district court relied on. And that actually arose in one of the cases that the defendant cites, which is at page 9 of our brief. And this whole unpublished order thing is a quandary that maybe there should, or maybe everything should be citable, or maybe nothing should be citable.
Nothing citable
sounds
better, actually.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Flaxman. Thank you to both of you.